This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website at progressive.org. Today we're going to be talking about Iraq, among other things, and my guest is Rahul Mahajan, author of Full Spectrum Dominance and The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism. Rahul Mahajan's blog, Empire Notes, at empirenotes.org, supplies invaluable insights into Bush's disastrous foreign policy. And Mahajan is also an activist serving as an elected steering committee member of United for Peace and Justice. Rahul Mahajan, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Great to be with you, Matt.
When were you last in Iraq?
Well, the last time I was in Iraq was actually in April of 2004. I went there twice in that year, and I was just fascinated by the things I learned, which at that time were being very poorly covered by the mainstream media. I'd have to say they do a lot better job now. But I wanted to stay longer, and the reason I left in April was that this was the start of, you know, that's when all hell broke loose in Iraq. There was the assault on Fallujah, the first assault. There was the battles with the Sadrists in the south. There was the rise of kidnappings and beheading of Nick Berg and so on. So I left at that time saying, I'll go back when things calm down, when the violence dies down a bit. Needless to say, I'm still waiting for that.
So that was April 2004, was just a little more than 1 year from the start of the war, from Bush's start of the war. Could you tell at that point that the seeds of catastrophe had already been sown?
You know, there have been several different phases of the occupation, each catastrophic in a different way. When I went there in January 2004, it was already a catastrophe. Then there was an insurgency and there was violence, but political violence, but that wasn't the primary problem. The primary problem was the United States had thrown the whole country into anarchy. It was in neglect. There was no government, no government services. There was a lot of crime, but the problem was essentially lack of order and plus the abuses by U.S. troops. Then in April, the second time, that was the start of the second phase in which the problem was large-scale violence between coalition occupying forces and insurgents, especially in Fallujah. And in that first assault, something that is still not very commonly known, something like 600 civilians were killed by the U.S. Marines. Then, of course, since then, there have been several other stages where the problem shifted to away from insurgent occupying forces violence to sectarian violence.
And we're pretty much in the sectarian phase now, or is the insurgency still a big element?
They are both definitely big elements, but the sectarian thing certainly not only is larger in terms of the number of people killed, it's also, if you look at the larger sort of political strategizing of the different groups, that is the base underlying reality. Even for the insurgents, they see what they call the Iranian occupation, or which is to say the political ascendancy of the Iraqi Shia, they see that as a bigger problem simply because it's more long-term. This is always the case. The people who are right there obviously are going to be there to stay for the next 50 years, whereas hopefully the United States forces are not.
Hmm. Now, it raises the question, you've seen so many different catastrophes of the occupation, the question being, could it ever have worked? Could they, if they did everything right, and, you know, no stuff happens, they didn't disband the army, you know, did the occupation have any chance of success?
Yeah, this is actually two questions, you know. The one is, could something like this have worked if it had been done by the right people? The second is, could the United States have done it? And I think these are two very different questions. It is not simply a matter of the Bush administration. It is true they made ridiculous mistakes that perhaps another administration would have made fewer of. In particular, the biggest one is they simply went in without having decided what political plan they had for Iraq. They were going to remove the regime and had no plan about what the new regime would be. That is not just a mistake. That is psychotic. But you know, U.S. forces from the beginning, they made themselves unliked in Iraq. They treated people badly. They were much more focused on force protection than they were on protection of civilians. There was racist contempt. There was the entire way in which it was done just showed a lack of any concern for the Iraqi people. If a different group of people with a different historical record who had genuine concern for Iraqis rather than a great deal of rhetorical concern and had sufficiently flexible institutions that they could have learned about the Iraqis, then perhaps it could have worked simply because they were ending Saddam's rule and they were also ending the sanctions, which were, you know, another horrible catastrophe visited on Iraq by a combination of Saddam and the United States. They had those chances, and also if it was reasonably quick, there was no way a long-term occupation could have worked.
Imperial motives would never have succeeded.
I do not think it could have worked. It could have, you know, not failed as badly as it has. That's clear. But I don't think it could have worked. No.
And where are we right now in Iraq?
Where we are right now, it's interesting to see how much of a divergence there is between where we are and where all of the pundits and all politicians and mainstream people say or think we are. I don't think anyone understands just how bad our, you know, the United States position in Iraq is. The fact is the United States has no political currency in Iraq. The only way it is able to wield any political influence whatsoever is through its occupying forces and through, you know, various external control of purse strings, like through IMF loans and so on. People talk about pressuring the Iraqi government or on the other side, when people talk about the Iraqi government as puppets, they're missing the basic fact that nobody in Iraq wants to do anything for the United States unless they are essentially forced to. The United States has no friends in Iraq. I mean, I'll give you one example which really astonishes me. The United States is obsessed with the idea that Iran is somehow funding and training and arming the Shia militias. And they're saying, these people, they're getting all this money, they're better trained militarily, they're getting new weapons and so on. And where is it coming from? This is the same United States that has allowed a political process that put the parties associated with the Shia militias in the government so they could get Iraqi oil money, oil revenues to use to build their base. The same one that has created an Iraqi army where they arm and train Shiite militias. So they're giving them money, weapons, and training to the Shia militias and asking who could be giving money, weapons, and training to the Shia militias.
I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. My guest today is Raoul Mahajan, who does the blog Empire Notes and the book Full Spectrum Dominance, among others. Was in Iraq most recently back in 2004. To what extent does Iraq have a government now?
Well, not to a very great extent. The government is not the primary source of order or social linkages or stability in many parts of the country and in many parts of Baghdad. Security in particular, insofar as it exists in neighborhoods in Baghdad, usually has to do with local militias much more than it does with the government. So it's not a government in a sense that we would recognize from a fully formed state. It is a government in one sense, no matter how lax it is, no matter how unable it is to cope with any of the bureaucratic challenges and administrative challenges Iraq faces, it still is the group that has the right to dispose of the large oil revenues that Iraq has. And therefore, it's able to retain some sort of a shell. It's able to have weapons. It's able to pay bodies of armed men and so on, some of the things that government does. But the other thing is, it is not a unitary government. It's split. You have these parties elected. They each get different numbers of seats from the elections. For Sadrist-affiliated parties have 30 out of 275 seats in the parliament. The Kurdish parties have about 60, if I remember correctly. Various different groups have different numbers of seats. To put together a majority governing coalition, you have to divide up the various ministries between the parties. Now, you're dividing up these ministries not in an established government with an established bureaucracy and clear modes of functioning. You're essentially giving each of those parties their little fiefdoms. So the Mahdi army, the Sadrists, their fiefdom includes the health ministry, the agriculture ministry, the transport ministry. To get a job in those, you need a recommendation from the Sadrist or a Sadrist-affiliated imam, similarly with any of the other parties. So it's really a whole bunch of different governments coexisting but also fighting each other.
And Bush has shown, or the administration has shown, let's just put it kindly, ambivalence toward Maliki. What option does the United States have?
Well, you know, I mean, the thing is that I don't think it's possible for the United States to do anything constructive in Iraq, even if that becomes its primary desire. And right now, it's very clear it's not. I mean, Bush is clear. Everything about the surge plan says to you, Bush is going back to the old idea, if you have enemies, smash them. That is what he's trying to do. If you looked at, like, they did a little briefing before his speech about the escalation, a typical PowerPoint with a bunch of superficial bullet points. One of the bullet points was that in the old plan, we thought that negotiating with the insurgents was a good idea. Now we recognize negotiating with them is not going to work, so we got to kill them. So their idea is purely just kill your enemies, not do anything good for Iraq. But and they confuse those two.
To what extent did they actually negotiate with the insurgents?
Well, you know, this is the thing. This is where the Bush administration is perhaps a little bit different, although not too different. You have the same problems in Vietnam, which is they believe that negotiation means telling the other side what your demands are and they're saying, yes, we'll obey you. Now, it turns out that when you negotiate without offering any concessions and you want maximal concessions from the other side, that is, in fact, not very effective in general.
Now, what about the surge? What effect is 20,000 more U.S. troops going to have?
Well, it's going to bring the troop levels back up to where they were in early 2005. It's not even, it's not even a larger number than we've had there in the past. It's really rhetorical. I mean, they could have added that number just through normal cyclical rotations and not even called it anything, and then no one would be talking about it. So it's not going to have much effect. Insofar as they actually do, you know, heighten their so-called security operations in Baghdad, it could have a catastrophic effect. In fact, according to at least the Iraqi health ministry figures, after they started Operation Together Forward in mid-2006, the fatality rate in Baghdad nearly tripled. So actually more people were dying through all kinds of violence, including, of course, occupying force violence, once they started those security operations and before. If they increase them further, well, that's probably going to increase the fatality rate as well.
It may increase the fatality rate in another way, in that Bush said in his surge speech that U.S. troops are going to have more flexibility, that they aren't going to, they're going to have looser rules of engagement. So essentially, they're going to be able to go knock down any door they want with impunity, it sounds like.
That's very scary. I mean, that means two things. One is more impunity for U.S. forces, and the other is there's some idea that the Iraqi government will not politically put political constraints, which is another way of saying the Iraqi government is not supposed to have any influence over this process.
Bush administration argument is the Maliki government is saying you can't go after Muqtada al-Sadr's militias, and U.S. forces are no longer going either to listen to him, or he no longer has the right to tell them they can't go after Muqtada al-Sadr. Tell me a little bit about Muqtada al-Sadr.
Well, in order to understand him personally, you have to understand that he comes not only – he's a Shia, and so the Shia have a long tradition of martyrdom. In their version, the first 12 Shia imams, the great leaders, were all murdered, assassinated. His personal family also, his great uncle, his father, his elder brothers, all of them murdered by Saddam. To him, the idea, the state is something that comes and murders you. And so that's part of why he's been so oppositional right from the beginning. He's a little paranoid about them. He speaks for the poor and dispossessed of Shiites who have never had anyone speak for them and were the ones who got the back of Saddam's hand. And it's interesting that the people who are, aside from the Kurds, worst treated by Saddam are now the constituents of this very anti-American force. They have committed all kinds of thuggish acts, as have most of the forces in Iraq, including obviously the occupying forces. Muqtada himself has often talked about Sunni-Shia reconciliation, and there are still some Sunnis who give him credit for it, so it's hard to tell how much of that is an act and how much of that is reality. But the key thing is this. Maliki is right. You cannot go after the Mahdi army for the simple reason that Sadrist-affiliated forces have 30 seats in the parliament. They have millions of people who voted for them. Anytime you're trying to destroy the social and political base of an organization that has millions of people behind it, you're talking about a level of violence that is just unacceptable.
Hmm. So play the game out a little bit. I hate to call it a game because it's so bloody. 20,000 more troops are going in. They're not going to be able to succeed. The level of violence is going to increase. What is Bush likely to do from there?
Well, he's obviously at first he takes a long time to change his mind about things. So he's gonna let it go for quite a long time, and people are going to be bringing in body counts of Mahdi army people and insurgents, and he's going to be excited and think, boy, we're making real progress because we're killing more evildoers. The big question is really not so much how Bush is going to react to this, but how the Democrats are going to react to it.
I mean, I've been surprised that they've gotten a little bit of spine, because Harry Reid in December was saying surge is okay by me for a couple of months. So, Rahul Mahajan, what is your reaction to the Democrats' response?
Well, I do agree that it's a pleasant showing of spine, even though it's likely to end up in a non-binding resolution or something, which everybody knows Bush is going to ignore. And essentially, I mean, he treats the Constitution as toilet paper. What is he going to do with the non-binding bipartisan resolution? But it is a lot more than they were saying even a few months ago. And I think part of it is it's political opportunism more than anything else. I think they believe Iraq is the one what brung them with these elections, and that they have to show a little more spine on Iraq in order to build for a better showing in 2008. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to push for policies that could actually be helpful.
What would some of those policies be?
Well, I think that, it's interesting to hear Hillary Clinton and others say, well, instead of surging in Iraq, we should be surging in Afghanistan. We should be fighting there instead of here. For what reason, I can't tell. Why the Taliban in Afghanistan is more of a threat than Al-Qaeda in Iraq? There's no logical reason for it. Why surging there, fighting there would be more helpful than Iraq, when in fact it's the fighting that has created the resurgent Taliban in Afghanistan, is unclear. But it shows that they're not out of the mindset. The basic problem with the whole war on terror mindset is that at this point, every time you commit an act of violence in the war on terror, you're digging deeper. Mm-hmm. And to understand that you should stop digging. The Democrats do not understand that we need to stop digging.
To play devil's advocate on Afghanistan, given that Osama bin Laden was there and Mullah Omar was housing him, what option did the U.S. have at that point after 9/11?
Well, I opposed the war in Afghanistan from day one, and I think there were good reasons for it. But I also think that it is a different question than the question of Afghanistan now. To some degree, actually, Bush is right. Afghanistan is no longer, there's no longer a place where they have a base for training people as they did, because they have U.S. forces there. That doesn't mean they have to go on killing people and fighting and creating a resistance in Afghanistan just the way they created the resistance in Iraq. Now, I think the first war in Afghanistan was wrong because there were better ways of dealing with this problem, and in particular of understanding that as long as people were in Afghanistan, they weren't much of a threat. It's when they come over here and fly planes that they become a threat, and that basically a lot could have been accomplished without actually committing violence, and also that the violence polarized the whole question. I mean, they've polarized the U.S. versus the Muslim world because of that violence. They didn't have to do it. So I think it was wrong even then. But now it's just clear there's no argument in favor of it. There's nothing. It's just the same thing they were doing in Iraq 2 years ago. They're doing in Afghanistan now.
One back to Iraq for a second. Argument about Anbar province is that there's Al-Qaeda there, and so Bush is going to send, 2,000 troops to Anbar province? Does that have any hope?
Well, again, I mean, they're sending a few thousand more Marines to Anbar to do more of the same, and the same is what has created a province which is, in which everybody hates the occupation, hates the American presence, in which fanatical extremists have political currency, which they never did before, really. I mean, this is new in Iraqi history, and even in Al-Anbar province, that these kinds of people would have any sort of political legitimacy, and increasing the violence is going to increase their legitimacy. The big thing that the U.S. has had going for it in Anbar and in fighting the insurgents is that the insurgents have been so completely undisciplined in their brutality and violence that even though the U.S. seemingly permanently alienated much of the population, the insurgents have then re-alienated them in a different way, and they're caught between two forces that they hate, basically.
What on the argument, if the U.S., this is the argument Bush uses now, if we leave, it's going to get worse. So, how do you respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, the time is long past to talk about rosy scenarios, and I think it could get worse. And if we leave and all other outside players, including the United States, try playing around with weapons and money and funding the various factions, it could even be worse than it is now. I mean, one thing we have to be clear is that when the U.S. leaves, we have to have some way of knowing that it's not engaging in covert operations in Iraq after it's left. But yeah, the violence could get worse. But the thing is that the only solution is clear. It's been clear for really at least a year or a year and a half. It's so clear that it's even becoming clear to some of the people in Washington, the only way forward is for the various feuding groups in Iraq to come to their own negotiated agreement. And they won't do that as long as the United States is there.
You know, for many listeners, I bet that's an unsatisfying answer, because people here, I hear all the time when I'm giving a talk that we made this mess, we have some moral obligation to stay there and clean up the mess. That's the only, you know, tug that people have. It's going to get worse. They're going to kill more people. And yet, you know, no one has a crystal ball and can promise that that's not going to happen. And yet it's so odd for the force that has imposed so much violence and so much death to be the rescuer. You must get that question all the time.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the first thing to you know, take a page from Hippocrates and say, you know, the first thing to do is first do no harm. And I argue, it's a longer argument than you can make in a short program, that the United States, for a variety of reasons, including its intentions, its practices, and its political position now in Iraq and the Arab world, has made itself incapable of doing any good. So the more it does in Iraq, the more harm it's going to cause. And that, it is true there's a moral obligation. It's also true the United States has made itself entirely unfit to meet that moral obligation.
What obligation would the United States have if it pulled the troops out? I mean, are there reparations, or should it just up and leave and let the Iraqis solve it?
Oh, I mean, I certainly think reparations are warranted, and I mean, tens of billions of dollars at the very least, you know, enough that to meet things like the World Bank estimates of 30 to 50 billion of how much Iraq needs to be reconstructed, although who knows, it may well be more by now. Unfortunately, that will never happen. I mean, we know the United States may leave off of wars in which it's not doing well, like in Vietnam, but it doesn't apologize and it doesn't pay. And, you know, in 1973, in the Paris Accords, they promised Vietnam over $3 billion in reparations. Vietnam has yet to see one cent of that. So I say, yes, we should call for it, but it's not going to happen, and we should know it's not going to happen.
I'm speaking with Rahul Mahajan, the program's Progressive Radio. Rahul Mahajan is author of Full Spectrum Dominance and does this blog Empire Notes at empirenotes.org, where he blogs a couple times a week about usually what's going on in Iraq. Interestingly enough, George W. Bush is talking about oil now in Iraq, where he wouldn't mention the word oil for about 3 years. Now it is one of the reasons for staying, because the terrorists may get hold of the oil. He also uses oil in the context of Iran. What is your view of the likelihood of U.S. action, Bush bombing Iran?
Well, I think that it's become very clear. I think the surge makes it clearer than ever just how much the United States has limited its own military capability in this. And Robert Gates, when he was testifying before Congress, suggested at one point that the surge was a way to scare Iran by showing them we're committed in the region. But it's 20,000 troops. It's a way, it does the opposite of scaring them. It shows them that you can't, even though you consider this important, you can't do anymore. In that same speech, he also mentioned sending an aircraft carrier battle group and so on, because I think they're frustrated that they have this large Navy and Air Force that they really can't throw into the battle in Iraq in any serious way, and they want to use it somehow to leverage it for more hegemony. But a Navy and an Air Force cannot do anything except a minor pinprick bombing in Iran, which is not going to accomplish anything. And so I think, you know, the equation remains what it has been. They don't have the forces to do anything substantial. They're not interested in doing something minor, and at the same time, they think it's intolerable if Iran gets nuclear weapons. So they've created a stalemate in which, you know, at least from month to month, nothing seems to change and nothing seems to move. And my prediction for the short term is that it'll remain that way.
What if it's not just pinprick bombing? What if it's a huge bombing campaign in Iraq. I mean, Seymour Hersh has been writing for 2 years now in the New Yorker that the Air Force at the Pentagon is not just going to take out two nuclear sites, but it's going to hit all the scientific buildings it can find and try to decapitate the regime.
You know, I think the United States has so discredited itself internationally that it would have a hard time dealing with the outrage that something like that would incur. It is true, I think, they might be able to make the American public go along with it, but I think there would be very serious repercussions, not least in the oil market, and I think that the Bush administration is well aware of that, and only the craziest people think that they can get away with something like that.
It looks to me the crazy people have been running the show for a while. So to me, that's not great solace.
There are degrees of craziness.
Okay, Raul. Peace movement. You've been involved with United for Peace and Justice for how long?
Since the first national conference in June of 2003.
Where is the peace movement today?
Sadly, I think the peace movement is almost nowhere. I mean, I think that we had an effect before the war. We helped to affect the public dialogue. I think recently, in the past couple of years, we've been living through this stunning paradox where, on the one hand, pretty much everything we said has been proven right. On the other hand, we are, if anything, even more discredited. We haven't gained any legitimacy out of it. The last time any of the anti-war stuff seemed to impact the public debate was when Cindy Sheehan sat outside Bush's ranch. And the total effects of that are unclear because they've also created a lot of hatred of Cindy and of the anti-war movement. I don't think we're getting through. I don't think we have built the capacity to inject ourselves into the public dialogue in a serious way. And I think the protests we're doing, while important, are becoming more and more of a pro forma exercise.
Well, what should we be doing then?
I think we need to focus on a job that is of the correct scale for us. Iraq is a huge thing, and we are a small movement with minimal links to the major organs of you know, affecting public opinion, the major media, and so on. And if we simply echo what mainstream people are saying, what Democratic politicians are saying, liberal journalists, we have no effect. People would rather hear from them. We can't go on the basis of bringing information to people's attention because it's the liberal journalists who are the ones who are in Iraq and actually writing good stuff about it. We can't find out anything except through reading them. What we need to do is try to refocus on the important moral issues that are not being addressed by any of the sides in the debate. We need to focus on, instead of how we can affect Iraq policy right now, how we can affect what are the lessons the nation learns from the Iraq occupation.
And what do you want those lessons to be?
Well, to start with, to completely lose the arrogance of thinking that we can actually dictate things. It's amazing that even the Democrats, who know that we can't win in Iraq, still retain this kind of arrogance of saying we can dictate this to the Iraqi government, we can change the way the people in the Middle East perceive us through this and that. It's just, none of it is working, and there's a reason for it. To lose the arrogance and the sort of moral superiority of thinking that the United States always has good intentions, or at least the best intentions in any given conflict, to learn that there's a price to be paid for demonizing people the way we have demonized Arabs ever since 1973. I mean, these are just off the top of your head. You can come up with at least a dozen lessons we should learn which are not being talked about at all.
But if we were right all along on the Iraq War, no one listened to us. If we're right on the lessons, we still have to get to people and have them listen to us. That's going to have to be a discussion for another time. My guest, Raul Mahajan, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thanks for having me.
Raul's book, Full Spectrum Dominance, you can get at a bookstore or library. You can read his blog, empirenotes.org, on the web. United for Peace and Justice, you can get on the web at unitedforpeace.org.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.